guys. I'm K2, Romeo, India Whiskey. My name is Dick. You'll also hear John, KC2WGV. John and Dick try to act as co-hosts for the thing called the Technical Med. That meets most Sunday evenings at 8 o'clock, usually lasts until midnight. If these guys got enthusiasm, they almost always do. Welcome to the world of ham radio, which I believe is probably the most beneficial hobby that you can consider. Highly educational, great for communication between different societies, and great for communication during periods of emergency. But highly educational about the world of wireless technology, how do radios really work, antennas, transmitters, and whatever. We try to tap into those subjects on each one of the sessions of the Technical Med. Wonder what that sound was. The world of ham radio has some real good guys in the New York, New Jersey, Connecticut area. A lot of brain power there. We try to tap into that. So people who ask questions on the Technical Med, quite often the answers come from those areas. The answers are not guaranteed to always be 100% accurate, but they become more accurate as time goes on. There's kind of a peer review process going on by way of this a beautiful website being run for the last 6.5 years by Mike Perry, KC2NJI. He runs a website that's titled, the web address for that is amateurradio.tangovictor. You go to that website, amateurradio.tangovictor, and you can listen to the last 6.5 years of TechMed. Dot
repeater, timeout, cancel.
You download those reels 1 hour at a time, and you can hear past TechNet. There's also individual selections for subjects that are very frequently asked about, like standing wave ratio and Smith chart, things like that. A person signs into the Technical Net by giving John and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. You need not sign in just because you're listening. After 30.5 years of the Technical Net, this net began in 1982 in September. So after 30 years, we believe somebody is listening. It's sort of been proven to us by now. And so we don't spend the time just having long lists of people telling us that they're listening. The TechNet is being carried by IRLP, Echo Link, other kinds of internet-like connections. And we hear tell that people in certain communities like Canada and California, the local repeater will pick up by internet connection or other connections, will pick up the Technical Net and, so to speak, broadcast it to their particular community. The guys in Canada, we hear quite frequently with their comments on what they've heard. Let me drop. What we should do periodically is not only wait for a gap between conversations that gives you all four beeps, but a couple of seconds beyond that to make sure that all of the systems in the outer areas get properly reset. We've heard comments from time to time that people in Canada, for instance, if we don't listen a little bit beyond the four beeps, then a person may not be able to sign in. Or Rich, KQUPS, who's traveling across the United States and communicating to us by very exotic techniques of a combination of cell phone and Echo Link and whatever, he needs a little bit more time for all the systems that he's communicating through to properly reset so that he can get in if he wants to. Okay, time for us to take those check-ins. Before I do, I'll tell you that I don't know if I'm going to do it at the beginning of the question-answer period or at the end of the question-answer period. I'm going to tell you on the job. A couple of days ago, I received the May issue of QST Magazine, and I found 4 very significant items in that issue with reference to regulations for how high a tower can be and your local covenants, conditions, and restrictions. In other words, the zoning law that we're being subjected to. Some progress, some significant progress is being made there. A very significant article on folded dipoles that are not properly extended, which is a question that was brought to us by data mesh, but really is a Dell network where, remember I was telling you guys a couple of weeks ago how you feed the outer end of a vertical dipole, a very significant antenna that takes a little bit more understanding, but once you're understanding it, once you develop an understanding of how an L network, a very simple single inductor, single capacitor, can give you any ratio of voltage or impedance step up that you want with or without simultaneous reactance cancellation, feeding the end of a dipole that is or isn't the end of a proper length to be resonant, how a very simple network with proper understanding can handle that all for you with a couple of hours with a part. It's a very unpopular antenna because of a lack of understanding, but I'd like to believe that's going to change. Okay, we're going to take questions and answers. We're going to take chickens at this time. So give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. A typical sign-in would be K2KMB, Rich and Yes. Do we have any check-ins? Give me your call letters and name right now. K2LAW.
AD2 Alpha Victor Uniform. Name is Tim. Yes.
So let me stop for a second there, Tim. Alpha Victor Uniform. And I think that was Kilo Bravo 2. Is that true, Tim? Go ahead.
Kilo Delta 2. Kilo Delta 2 Alpha Victor Uniform. Name is Tim. It's Kilo Delta over.
Fantastic, Tim. We got you. Okay. Anyone else to check in? Please give me your call letter and name right now.
KD2CMQ, Neil. Yes.
Kilo Delta 2, Charlie Mike Quebec. We got you, Neil. All right, the next person.
This is KC2, Queen Yankee Whiskey. Name is Joe and
Okay, we got you, Joe. Anyone else to check in with a question or a comment? Give me your call letters and name right now. Okay, I heard John and something Delta. Give me the call letters again, John. Okay, you're saying it fast. Your signal is extremely weak. You've got to slow down and do whatever you can to give me a stronger signal. I think I heard Whiskey 2 Delta, but I'm not sure. Give that to me again, John, slowly.
Okay,
your audio is extremely low. Now it sounds like Whiskey 2 Sierra Delta. Please speak a little louder and give me a yes if I got that right, John.
Whiskey 2 Sierra John.
Whiskey 2 Sierra John. Thank goodness you spoke louder. We're hearing you now, John. Okay. Anyone else? Give me your call letters.
WS2N Space Report, Paul, going to be.
Okay, we got you, Paul. Looking forward to that space report. Anyone else to check in with a question or a comment? Give me your call letters right now.
Center H3N, after Paul.
We got you, Wes. Okay. And I should have mentioned that after we spent approximately the first hour and a quarter answering people's questions briefly, and by the way, for questions and answers that need a more significant answer, that takes place at a later time. But after the first hour or so, John, KC3WGB, is going to go to the mailbag for those who have given him an email or a snail mail because they don't have their ham radio license yet or don't have the equipment yet where they can talk to us directly. The TechNet is a live question and answer period. And for the most part, with the exception of the mailbag, we don't really promise to give people a free consulting service during the rest of the week. And after that mailbag, Paul, WS2N, our space expert, tells us what National Aeronautics and Space Administration has been doing. And by way of that alpha magnetic spectrometer that's on the International Space Station, which is now starting to discover a large number of positrons. In other words, we're starting to see evidence of antimatter in space. I've got a theory as to where it's coming from. So, you ain't heard the end of that story yet. Okay, Tim's our first question with a real question. Kilo Delta 2 Alpha Victor Uniform. Go right ahead, Tim. KQLIW, my name is Dick.
KQLIRW, KD2AVU. Good evening to you, Dick, and good evening to the net. I've got a question about antenna stacking, which is generally for VHF and UHF antennas. I have five antennas from 6 meters to 220 and a parallel 432 and also a 2 meter beam that I wanted to stack, but I've been reading online about the antenna stacking distance, and it seems the distance is very critical to the performance performance of the antenna. But the problem is I only have 5 feet of the antenna mast, or maybe 6 feet. So I just wanted to ask the question: which way is the best way to stack five antennas on a six feet mast? Over to you, Dick. That is just my questions. Over.
Very good question. Awful glad you asked it, Tim. This is a slightly controversial area, and even some of the very well-educated people on the subject of antennas, in my opinion, get this one wrong. If I was putting two antennas together that are both on the exact same HF or VHF or UHF frequency, two antennas on the same frequency, one of the things that's not obvious is that every antenna has a real effective capture area. If your eyes operated at 432 megacycles, for instance, and you stand off at a good long distance and you look down the throat of a Yagi on 432, let's talk about a Yagi that I know something about, the 19-element Yagi by K2RIW. The boom is around 12 and a half feet long. It's got 19 individual elements. Each element is about 12 inches long, each element. So you look down the boom, you see a 1.5-inch diameter boom, and you see a bunch of elements all behind each other, 1.5 foot long. So if your eyes operated at 432 megacycles, what you would really see is a great big round black hole in space, 5.5 feet in diameter. Let me drop. So in other words, that antenna is taking a horizontally polarized signal, for instance, on that frequency, and if it's within that 5.5 foot diameter circle, all of that signal operates on all of those individual elements that are only 12 inches long, and it creates a focusing effect like a magnifying glass, that long string of directors. The signal gets focused down to the driven element picks it up, sends it down the transmission line to your receiver, and in theory it takes the S meter, the signal strength meter. So 5.5 foot diameter. Therefore, if you're stacking a pair of those particular Yagis, each Yagi has a different length and a different amount of gain, therefore a slightly different capture area. So I could give you a formula where you can calculate the capture area. So you're going to stack them at a distance where the two individual Yagis, the round circles of their capture area, just kiss each other or overlap a little bit. If you stack them any closer than that, you start losing gain because now you have overlapping areas, and the signal trying to go down the middle between the two has got a conflict of interest, if you know what I mean. So a pair of those 19 element Yagis, the right stacking distance is around 5 feet. Let me drop. Now let's say I'm stacking a single 432 Yagi above a single 220 Yagi. Now the world gets very different. When you're on 220 megacycles, that 220 Yagi, I'm going to guess, probably has a 7 foot diameter capture area. The 432 Yagi, we already know, has got about a 5 foot diameter capture area. Therefore, a person being super conservative using good common sense would say, well, okay, the 220 and the 432 Yagi, one of each stacked above each other, add the two together, 7 foot 5, I should stack them 12 feet apart. Good common sense, dead wrong. Because when you're on 220 megacycles, that 432 Yagi doesn't exist. Its capture area is probably a square inch. It's not there. Correspondingly, when you're on 432 megacycles, the 220 Yagi doesn't exist. It's a piece of metal nearby, but it has almost no capture area. The real fooler along these lines is that when you combine a 2-meter Yagi with a 432 Yagi, we all know it's got a 3-to-1 relationship in frequency. Therefore, you would say, boy, they're going to interfere with each other like crazy. Not necessarily so. Because in order for that Yagi on 2 meters of 432 to do its swing, every one of those directors has got a very specific length that's shorter than the resonant length. They represent a capacitive reactance, like a capacitor sitting at that spot in space. And they got a very specific spacing. You put that all together just right with a good Yagi design. And in the case of that Yagi I described earlier, you pick up a 5.5-foot diameter circle with effective capture area. You feed that Yagi on its third harmonic frequency, for instance, and the spacing is wrong, the reactance is wrong, the gain is not there. The bottom line is a 2-meter Yagi and a 432 Yagi, for instance, stacking one above the other.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Stacking one above the other, where the 2-meter Yagi may have a 12-foot diameter circle, the 432 Yagi got a 5.5-foot diameter circle, you think you got to stack them at 17 feet. You can stack them at about 1.5 feet. You're about to say, how come? Okay, the capture area on the other frequency essentially doesn't exist. Therefore, the only thing that happens, the 2-meter Yagi doesn't even know the 432 Yagi is there, in that example. Doesn't even know it's there. You could stack the Yagi on 432 exactly on top of the 2-meter Yagi, where the booms are touching each other. The 2-meter Yagi wouldn't know it's there, that the 432 Yagi is there. The 432 Yagi, the tips of the elements do see the nearby metal of the 2-meter Yagi elements, and it adds some extra capacitance to them, tunes them to a slightly lower frequency. You stack the 432 Yagi a foot and a half or so, maybe even a foot, but a foot and a half to be conservative, away from the 2-meter Yagi, the amount of capacitive loading is so small, very little detuning takes place. Let me show you one other example here. Way back before you guys were even born, so to speak, way back in the mid-60s, there was something called the Fenco 6 and 2 antenna. The Fenco company had come up with this Yagi where there were 2-meter elements and 432 elements on the same boom, stacked in between each other. The designer of that antenna represented, he knew the fact that the 2-meter Yagi elements never even saw the 432 elements that were on the same boom. The 432 elements, so the ones that were close to a 2-meter element, did see some extra capacitive loading, got tuned to a slightly lower frequency. He shortened them accordingly to bring them back into the design. And now he had full performance on 2 meters and 432 simultaneously on one boom. That should give you some ideas. If you want to set up a good antenna range and you want super close stacking, or you want to build your own antenna design where multiple bands are on the same boom, the laws of physics will let you do that. Okay, so let's get back to Tim's exact situation here. The 6-meter Yagi is the big one. Let me drop. It's the big one with the long boom. It's got the highest moment of inertia. It's got the most amount of weight. Therefore, you'd like it closest to the pivot on the top of the tower, and you want that to the bottom of the mast. So the 6-meter Yagi is on the bottom, in my recommendation. The 2-meter Yagi above that, I think you can stack it a foot or so, foot and a half of away. The 220 Yagi, 1 foot away. The 432 Yagi, even less than a foot away for one single Yagi. But now there's a catch. Because you've got a pair of 432 Yagis in your example, Tim, and they, because they're both on the same frequency, they should be 5 feet apart. So therefore, a modification of all of this would be, take the stack that I've now described, move it all up a foot or two, 2 feet, put a single 432 Yagi at the bottom of the stack, then the 6, then the 2, then the 220, then the 432, second Yagi, at the top of the stack. So now that
I'll put the two 432 Yagi side by side, rather than one above the other.
Okay, that was Barry in 2MB, and that's another solution. So if you want a pure vertical stack, then because you've got two antennas on the same band, putting them one on the bottom and one on the top of the stack is a way of simultaneously getting their proper stacking as well as the individual stacking of the other antennas. Barry is telling you there's another approach. If a pair of 432 Yagis were stacked horizontally displayed side by side, That's another approach, but there's two catches to that. Number one, you got to make this upside down or right side down up U-shaped horizontal bar with some vertical ends on it to mount those Yagis if they're horizontally polarized, because you don't want to mount a horizontal polarized Yagi on a horizontal piece of mast coming out of the main mast out of the tower, because that's going to, again, give you some capacitive loading that's going to give you some funny effects if you're not willing to retune. By making that into a U-shaped piece of metal, you can stack the two horizontal. So with that extra mechanical doodad, you can do that. There's one other catch. Let me drop. And that is, if you've got the resources to do pure vertical stacking, you get by far the simplest antenna pattern. Whatever antenna pattern you would have out of one single Yagi, when they are properly fed and vertically stacked, now as you rotate an azimuth, you get the exact same pattern with two as you do with one, except that everything is 3 dB louder. It's kind of nice. When you stack them side by side, your main lobe of that interferometer you just created is going to get about half as wide or a third as wide as it was before. You're going to develop some significant side lobes that are only going to be 10 or 12 dB down, and there's an advantage and a disadvantage of those. It makes turning the antenna in azimuth and figuring out how to foresight on a guy a little bit more difficult when you've got horizontal stacking. But if you live in a metro area and you've got a lot of strong stations nearby, the fact that you get these individual side lobes with a deep notch between them, you can now take an interfering signal, move him into one of those notches, while the signal you want to listen to is on the main lobe or on one of those strong side lobes, and now you can drastically improve signal-to-noise ratio of listening to two simultaneous signals that are nearly on the same frequency. So there's pluses and minuses here of horizontal and vertical stacking. But the bottom line that Tim wants to know, let me drop. The bottom line is that when the antennas are on individual different frequencies, vertical stacking can be amazingly close. A bunch of people have followed my advice on this. Quite a few of them have come back and said, yeah, it worked like a charm. I didn't believe it. The most extreme example I remember was John Chandle, the B2FUZ, I think was his call letters, in Levittown. He built a great big bed spring, which had, as I remember, 8 Yagis on 432, 4 Yagis on 2 meters, all built into the same frame, with individual Yagis inside of each other, alongside of each other, in this frame. So when you're on different frequencies, extremely close stacking worked like a charm. He swept that antenna. We measured the antenna pattern of it. He did some moon bounce with it. Worked like a charm. I bet you Barry has done things like that also. Give us a couple of words, Barry, on stacking distances that you've used horizontally or vertically. You've been there with your great big tower there in Far Rockaway, and they've done quite a bit of moon bounce. So give us some words on what stacking results you have seen, Barry. N2 moon bounce, K2LIW in the deck net.
Okay, yeah, I did, I made an H frame. Actually, it was like a double H frame. I had two horizontal pieces of aluminum and four vertical pieces. So I had four 2-meter beams on the outside and four 432 antennas on the inside. It was actually kind of like a double H frame, sort of. And that worked very, very well. I got the exact distance I wanted between the antennas. And you don't have to do this necessarily. If this gentleman has different antennas on different frequencies, he could make this H frame and put, antennas all around it of different frequencies. And, of course, the two 432 antennas, he could get them spaced exactly right. And they would, again, they could either be side by side or one above the other, however he wants to do it. And to Mike Lovell.
Good information, Barry. And that's if he's willing to do extra things with horizontal bars connected to his main mast to do some horizontal stacking as well as vertical stacking. At first, I know Tim is trying to keep it simple. He's got 5 or 6 feet single mast coming out of the top of the tower, and he wants to stack these antennas, and we're giving some advice on that one, Tim. Now, Tim, I know we gave you a lot of information in a hurry. I know darn well that not all of it made sense at first. By way of the website, amateurradio.tangovictor, you can play it back slowly. I believe there's also a way, if you go to the LIMOC.org, I think there's a way you can get a playback of the audio through the LIMOC net, so that there's ways you can take what we've just said to you, play it back a few times, or it'll make a little more sense. And even if you don't get the chance to do that, Tim, this is a good enough question, broad enough requirement of a lot of hands. You're allowed to come back next week and the week after that, ask the question again, ask other variations of it, and we'll try to give you an answer. So you're going to get help on this one, Tim. You're in a good area. Kilo Delta 2, Alpha Victor Uniform, K2RAW. Go ahead, Tim.
K2RAW, KD2AVU returning. Very good. Thanks a lot, guys. Actually, I noticed that on the 220 band, I got some return power on the SW meter when I transmit on 2 meter. But there's definitely no reflected power on the 432 if I transmit on 2 meter or the other way around. But on 222, there are some reflected power from the 2 meter antenna. So that is just my main concern. And all my antennas, right now it's just in the attic and stacking very closely to each other. But now I took the 220 antenna off of the mast and I'm running a pair of stacked 432 with the 2 meter antenna in between. I can see there's no interference whatsoever, but on the 222 antenna, I definitely see about almost 500 milliwatt reflected power. Thanks for the answers there, Dick, and also and to Moonbounce Barry. Back to the net, KD2AVU.
Yeah, you brought up another area that I should have addressed, Tim. I was now concerned with the gain, pattern, and performance of the individual Yagis that are closely stacked when you're transmitting and receiving on one of those antennas, and those antennas are nestled with other antennas. Another complete factor is what you're calling return, but it really is cross-coupling. If I transmit on 6 meters, in theory, I'm a little bit concerned with how much 6-meter antenna energy is going to come back down the 2-meter antenna feed line. And 220, when I transmit on it, how much is going to come back down the 6-meter and so on. Cross-coupling. Coupling coefficient between the antennas. An entirely different area. When you see milliwatts coming back down, with rare exception with modern-day transceivers, they can tolerate a couple of watts on the wrong frequency coming into the front end without any damage. And if you've got super close stacking, and you do have a significant amount of cross-coupling, with the proper uses of bandpass filters, you could protect the receivers. I will admit that if you want to receive simultaneously on one band while transmitting simultaneously on another band, and you didn't want the receiver to be overloaded or desensitized or get into modulation distortion, there with close stacking, I'll admit that the life gets a little bit more complicated, but if you have to do that, proper bandpass filtering could eliminate almost all of that problem. And the filters themselves, let me drop. The filters themselves that I'm toward describing, you can either buy them or build them. The raw materials to build the filter are not expensive, but it's a fair amount of a requirement to find the design, find the materials, properly tune it. It's a little bit of a pain, I'll admit that. And just writing a check and have the problem go away and buy a good bandpass filter is one possible solution. But where your antennas are now being vertically stacked inside of an attic is what you just told us, Tim. That's another slight complication, because when antennas are inside of a building, even though you inside your attic you see wooden rafters and wooden sheeting with the shingles, and you completely forget about the fact that there is conduit wiring on the floor of the ceiling of the attic, where conduit wiring and maybe ductwork for the air conditioning. There's other metallic objects nearby, and even the wood of the attic, and the wood on a rainy day when there's a lot of water on the shingles on the outside, it will give you some change in performance. So when you get antennas inside of a building like you're describing, life gets a little bit more complicated. The cross coupling gets a little bit greater, because you don't know it, but that radio energy is not looking at that rafter as a completely transparent object. It sees it as a fairly large capacitive object in space with a dielectric constant of 3 as opposed to the air that's 1 dielectric constant around it. So things do change. In fact, with antennas in an attic, you'll probably see some change in standing wave ratio or cross-coupled energy as you rotate those antennas. You'll see some change. And if you have the ability to put the antennas outside the house on the chimney, you will get better performance, less rain interference, and so on. I know that my job... We'd all like to keep our antennas indoors so that they last forever and don't get weathered outdoors. A much better approach, in my opinion, Tim, if the landlord will let you do it, if you're able to put the antennas outside the building where you get better performance, with the proper selection of the materials, you can make the antenna last for 10 years. You might have to do some maintenance every 5 or 10 years, clean things up a little bit with aluminum oxide removal and things like that. But still, don't be afraid of putting antennas outside if your landlord will let you do that. Now back to you for any final on this one, Tim. KD2ABU, make sure you wait for all four beeps. K2LAW in the tech man.
K2LAW, KD2ABU returning. Yeah, very good, Dick, and that's why I'm asking your question. I definitely wanted to put the antenna outside, and all my antennas are homebrews. And I use 60-61 tubings, quarter-inch tubings for the elements, and also 60-63 aluminum for the boom, and all the insulators are made out of PVC pipes, and use stainless steel screws all the way. And the antenna matching balun, whatever, choke, it's housed inside a waterproof case, so weatherproof is not a problem for me, but I can definitely see the help of by putting the antenna outside, so that's why I'm planning on doing this. And another thing about the putting the different element on a single boom. I mean, a different element for a different band on a single boom. There is a design it's called open sleeve design that you can actually use the 2 meter driven element and put a 432 driven element is just in front of the 2 meter one, and make it resonant on that frequency. So you only need one single feed point on the antenna. And I do have one myself, and that I use for portable operations, and it works pretty well. And information can be found on Delta Kilo 7.
We lost the last 5 seconds because you timed out the machine, Tim. Tim's in Mineola, and I'm looking at his QRZ.com setup now. Good-looking setup. And I'm seeing some of your antennas. Very nicely done. So homebrew, we amateurs really shine when it comes to homebrewing antennas. Nowadays, to homebrew a transceiver, handheld or base station type, a mobile type, is essentially out of the question. You homebrew something on 10 gigahertz because you can't buy enough of them. But on 80 through 1296, 80 meters through 1296 meg, you're going to buy it. But when it comes to the antennas, and Tim's a homebrewer from way back, I can tell, that's where we can get a lot of bang for the dollar. A lot of knowledge is gained by doing it, experimenting, finding out what works. And so, looks like you got a good setup there, Tim. Come back next week and let us know how it goes as you make these other changes. I'm going to have to move on, and we're going to go to Neil next. KD2, Charlie Mike Quebec. Go right ahead, Neil. K2LIW TechNet. My name is Dick.
Good evening, Dick. I have a question about bollards. I'm planning on putting up an off-center fed dipole. I know I need a 4-to-1 current bollard. I'm only running 100 watts. And I thought I had everything all figured out until I heard on the TechNet, and I apologize for not remembering the individual's name, but somebody seemed to speak with a fair amount of authority on the subject, saying that it's easy to make a bollard, basically a transformer, but it's hard to make one that will broadband, which I'm planning on with an antenna tuner using this off-center fed dipole for covering as much of the spectrum as I can.
Good question at a good time. I'm looking for the right page of the May issue of QST Magazine for a guy who's got, there it is, page 46. Page 46 of the May issue. This guy has got the most broadband, high-power ballon I have ever seen made out of relatively inexpensive material. He's winding RG214 type cable through 5 ferrite stacked objects, putting it all inside of this PVC piece of tubing. Very nicely designed, homebrew ballon. By the way, ballon is B-A-L-U-U-N. Baker, Lima, Uncle, November. It stands for balance to unbalance. Balance to unbalance is a contraction of two words, Neil. And so, balancing structures, there's all kinds of them. They fall into two or three different categories. One is the kind that operates as an RF choke, which won't allow any RF energy to flow down the outside of the coax cable, which is, in many cases, a very desirable thing to do. Let me drop. So the RF choking type balance when you use a coaxial cable, very desirable. And this particular one, I'm pretty sure the author is telling you, it runs at least 150 watt level, if not beyond. I think you can possibly run at the kilowatt level. And 80 through 10 meters and maybe even 6 meters, I think he mentioned. So May issue QST, page 46, article entitled, An Easy to Build High Impedance Choke Balance by K4Z Hotel Mike. Looks like a very nicely done article. So making the broadband, you got to work a little bit harder, but it's very, very doable. In my opinion, if you have enough turns of coax cable held together with black tape or tie wraps, you come very close to the same performance. The nice thing about using these ferrite things is that you can make a more compact structure needing less coax cable. So there's some pluses and minuses there as I see it. So what I'm starting to say, let me drop. In many cases, one of the high priorities for building a balun is for choking action. Another priority for building balun-like structures is for impedance matching. You could build balun-like structures in order to get 2-to-1, 4-to-1, 8-to-1, 5-to-1 impedance match simultaneously with RF choking action in some cases. But the word balun really means balance to unbalance. In other words, a pure dipole antenna, whether it's part of the driven element of a Yagi or it's a dipole all by itself, is, in theory, a thoroughly balanced structure. When you feed it in the most ideal way, at one instant time, you're putting positive voltage on the right side of the dipole and negative voltage on the left side of the dipole during the first half cycle, and you reverse that during the second half cycle. That's the ideal way to feed it. And just putting a piece of coax cable there, where the shield goes to the left side and the center conductor goes to the right side, does not quite do that. It's not a complete showstopper, but the simple coax connection that I just described will launch RF energy back down on the coax cable. And these choking devices, the choking type balance we're talking about right now, like page 46 of the May issue, makes that stop happening. It's one of the many ways to make it stop happening. So there is a solution to that. And when you do get current flowing down the outside of the coax cable, it doesn't make things catch on fire. It's not the end of the world. It just means that now your transmission line is part of the antenna, which complicates the antenna pattern, indoor efficiency, indoor gain. And so an acute increase in the amount of television interference if that cable happens to go by the television set in the living room of your house, if you know what I mean, or by the apartment building, by the apartment of your next-door neighbor. So there's a lot of desirable characteristics of stopping the RF energy going down the outside of the cable by way of
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
As I was starting to say, by way of a balancing device. So if you got some further questions on this, Neil, don't lose a whole lot of sleep over this one. And it's not a very difficult problem to solve, in my opinion. And I'm glad you're researching it. KD2, Charlie Mike, Quebec, K2RIW. You got it, Neil? Wait for the full beep, please.
I'm sorry, and I'm sorry if I didn't make myself clear. I'm more concerned about a impedance matching, a 4-to-1 Balaam, for, since it's an off-center fed dipole, that's more what I'm looking for is information on what I should be looking for when I'm shopping around for a 4-to-1 Balaam. Over.
Let me start off, Neil, by telling you that the way you pronounce the word balun will have some of your fellow ham radio listeners thinking that you're not familiar with what you're talking about. There is no M, there is no mic in the word balun. It's only got November, B-A-L-U-U-N, November, not mic. So pronounce it with no M. Otherwise, people will say some funny things to you. When you want a 4-to-1 impedance match, there are lots of ways of doing that. The half-wave coax balance is one of the most popular ways. In other words, you take a piece of coax cable appropriate for your frequency range that's electronically a half-wave length long, fold it into a U-shape. In other words, bring the two shields back together and solder the shields together along with the shield of the transmission line. The center conductor of the transmission line goes to one of those center conductors on the U-shape. Now, when you take your output signal from the two center conductors of the U-shape piece of coax cable, that is a 4-to-1 impedance match. When you study what that thing does, it gives you a 2-to-1 voltage step up. By way of the half wavelength of coax cable, the left side center conductor, right side center conductor are all exactly 180 degrees out of phase, and twice voltage. So you do get a 4-to-1 impedance match at one frequency. That's the one catch with that one. That's only a one frequency, but a very efficient thing that's often used on VHF frequencies. Let me drop. But now if you're trying to get a 4-to-1 impedance match on a whole lot of bands at once, which is a very unusual requirement, kind of curious as to what kind of an antenna would do that. A fan dipole wouldn't have that requirement. But if you do have that requirement, there are ways of using ferrite toroids with properly wound enameled wire on them, which will give you very broadband 4-to-1 impedance match. There you're going to have to do a little bit more research. If you Google the word balun, B-A-L-U-N or B-A-L-U-U-N, N for Nancy, you Google that word. Do a search with Google. Guarantee you're going to find a zillion of these articles that'll tell you how to do it with ferrite toroid. Choosing the right ferrite toroid, winding it correctly, you'll get exactly what you want. There's a lot of research on that. Let's see now. W2FMI. Jerry Civic. If you simply Google the word Jerry Civic, W2FMI, Whiskey 2, Charlie, Mike, India, I think it is, yes. He had a whole series of articles in QST Magazine 25 years ago. If you're an ARRL member and you look at the archives and you look for W2 Charlie Mike India, you'll get a lot of information on that exact subject, but Googling it is another way. When I pass it back to you, drag your feet a little bit, Neil, because maybe somebody listening in the tri-state area has already done it and is going to tell us exactly where to go. KD2, Charlie Mike Quebec to take it with a little bit of delay. K2LIW in the TechNet.
KD2AV with a comment.
Okay, go right ahead, Tim. There was a second person. I'll pick you up in a minute. Tim first. Go ahead, Tim.
Two different kinds of 421 battalion myself, both use ferro torrent core. And I found out the best one for Windom antenna, which is the off-center fat dipole antenna. The best way to do it is to use a current battalion instead of a voltage 421 battalion. And since the 3-point takes more current than other than voltage, if you end load the antenna, it's going to take more voltage than the off-center FET. So for W3EDP antenna, which is more like a J-pole antenna, you might want to use the voltage 421 voltage balance. But for off-center FET dipole, definitely go with current balance, current 421 balance. That's my comment, over.
Yeah, one of the first questions people ask is, what's the difference between a voltage balance and a current balance? In most cases, the word current balance really means it's a combined structure that does impedance matching as well as RF choking. So if your balancing device can do impedance matching and stop any RF energy from flowing back down the outside of the coax, classically they call that a current balun. And the voltage balun doesn't necessarily do that. So Whiskey 3 Echo Delta Papa apparently has a design. And let me turn it back to you, Neil, because I'm a little bit curious. What in the world requires 4-to-1 impedance match and broadband? In other words, covering multiple ham radio bands simultaneously. Kind of curious what kind of an antenna requires that, Neil. KD2, Charlie Mike Quebec, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I'm trying to use an off-center fed dipole, basically in a Windom design, to cover as much of the ham bands as I can, so I don't have to put up a bunch of antennas, because to be honest with you, it took some negotiation with my neighbor to be able to have enough room just to put this one up. Over.
Good answer, Neil. Now I understand. And 1 or 2 weeks ago, we had a somewhat similar discussion in which the questioner was asking a similar question, how to fight a Carolina Windom. This Windom, which is a one-wire feeding mechanism that was popular way back in the 50s, and there's a more modern version of the Carolina Windom, which is set with a coaxial cable and a balancing-like structure. When it comes to feeding an antenna that operates on multiple bands, Windom is one approach. Another approach is fan dipole, and to me, the fan dipole is a little bit easier, but because the way that works is that if I wanted an antenna for 80, 40, 20, and 10, for instance, I literally would build 4 dipoles, bring them all together in the exact same center structure, put the right kind of a balancing device there, and they're going to be very close to 50 or 70 ohms, all 4 of them, and the RF energy goes down the right dipole automatically. Only the resonant one will absorb the energy, and the others will essentially be ignored. So a fan dipole. And the first question people ask is, okay, where the individual dipoles that are all parallel to each other, you need a little bit of separation at the end. How much separation is required? That's a function of how much tuning you want to do. There are people who have made a fan dipole. Let me drop. There are people who have taken the ribbon cable that's intended for feeding a rotator and been cutting it up just right, took 4 parallel or 5 parallel pieces of it, all chopped together in the center, I mean all fed together in the center, and changing the various lengths, where now you've got very little separation, only the separation of the ribbon cable itself. And they've made a fan dipole out of that. The only catch is that the 80-meter dipole is exactly the right length. The 40-meter dipole, because of being very, very close to the 80-meter dipole, the capacitance added to the tips on the 40 means you've got to make a significant amount of shortening of the 40 to bring it back into resonance. But it's a fairly simple process where you would sweep your ring across 40 meters. In other words, you transmit a small amount of power at 40 at 7.0, 7.1, 7.2, 7.3 megacycles. Plot the standing wave ratio. You're looking for that bathtub-shaped curve, and if the bottom of the bathtub is in the middle of the band where you want the best performance, then you know you got the right length. If it's a little bit too long, the bathtub will be shifted over to the left. Or if it's a little bit too short, the bathtub will be shifted over to the right. So it's a fairly simple tuning procedure where you can select your own separation, so to speak, of the fan dipole. So you've got at least two approaches here, as I see it, Neil. The fan dipole approach, which is a little bit simpler to me, but that's just me. And there are other people who just love the Carolina Wyndham with the right kind of a 4-to-1 balancing device broadband up on it. So back to you for any further questions on this, Neil. KD2, Charlie Mike, Quebec, wait for the four beeps. K2RIW in the TechNet.
I do have some more research to do on this then, I guess. Thank you for your information, Dick. I appreciate it. Well, back over to you.
Very fine, Neil. And by the way, as you do it, and you're in an ideal place called Glen Oaks, as you do this research and you find out what works and you start building it, come back periodically and tell us how it goes, because you're in a situation that a lot of other people are in that would like to know what has worked. And you're going to be giving us hands-on experience on that one, Neil. Joe is next. Pillow Charlie 2, Quebec Yankee Whiskey. Oh, wait a minute. That was a no. Okay. The next one was John. Whiskey 2 Sierra, I think it is. Or Whiskey 2 Sierra John. Whichever it is. John, go right ahead with your question. K2RIW. My name is Dick.
Thanks, Dick. Just checking in. WW2S.
Okay, John. Okay, so, hey, we're actually a little bit ahead of schedule tonight. Oh, one last call. Did I miss anybody who has a question? Because they arrived late. We got a little bit of extra time here where we can pick you up right now. Give me your call letters and name if you really have a question or a comment. K2LAW.
Comment, Dick, K2GJE.
And then to XGN, just the question, did you have a chance to go to the email? I sent you interesting stuff about Mars.
I haven't seen my email in the last 24 hours, Wes. Now, K2GJE, go right ahead with your comment, sir. K2LIW.
You can see that Wyndham with 450 ohm ladder line. He won't need any balance if he has an antenna tuner with a balanced output over the net.
Okay, Ed, thank you. So, the more choices that Neil has, so if he sees it with ladder line, the nice thing about ladder line is that even though it might be feeding an antenna with an extremely high standing wave ratio, maybe the 4-to-1 balun would ordinarily be taking 50 ohm coax and bringing it up to 200 ohms. And maybe the ladder line that you can get your hands on is 400 ohm or 600 ohm ladder line. So therefore you're saying, I'm going to have a pretty significant standing wave ratio. The nice thing about ladder line is that if you've got the right kind of an antenna tuner that properly feeds the ladder line, the ladder line itself can tolerate an extremely high standing wave ratio. If you use ladder line in a situation where you've got a 10-to-1 standing wave ratio between the antenna and the transmission line, that means a lot of energy is reflecting back and forth in the transmission line before it finally gets radiated. And so your signal is traversing the insertion loss of your ladder, of your transmission line, multiple times. That's where the extra loss is coming from. But if the loss starts off for darn low to begin with, as ladder line usually is, you can get away with it. The antenna tuner is in the shack. As long as it's got enough antenna tuning range to it, the ladder line with the high vis run works like a charm. So ladder line does require some extra care. Bringing it into the house is a little bit difficult, and the way you sustain suspend it outside. You're not going to lay it up against a metallic object and just tape it down like you can with coax. You got to have some extra spacing in there for it to obey all of its impedance rules, if you know what I mean. But it can, as a useful transmission line, it's got some fantastic characteristics. Let me drop. Another nice thing about ladder line, as long as you can get a hold of 16-gauge, 14-gauge, 12-gauge wire, whatever is your favorite, it is a kind of transmission line with high performance that you can homebrew to be able to make those spreaders that are periodically along the transmission line, keeping the spacing between the two approximately right. And whether you build them out of wood and coat them with something to keep the weather off the wood, or make them out of plastic or porcelain or any other of these insulating materials, to homebrew ladder line is relatively easy. The real classic ham radio operators in the old days did just that. So something worth considering, and I thank you for that information, Ed. Okay, I'm going to go over to the mailbag now, John. KC2WGB, those scientists that write you these emails, my goodness, the things that they seek are darn interesting. What kind of interesting mail have you gotten this week, John? KC2WGB, K2LAW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Good evening, Dick. Everyone on the net. We've got an antenna question for you this time. Hey, Dick. let me let it drop and I'll start over. Okay, we have a gentleman who homebrewed a 2-meter, 70-centimeter antenna. Okay. He has a length of PVC pipe. And on the outside of the pipe, he placed a half-wave dipole vertically, and he has a 2-meter half-wave dipole. They come down to a diplexer. He's having trouble tuning the 70-centimeter, which seems to work fine when it's not mounted on the PVC pipe. Maybe you can give him a hint on this one, what to do. He cannot get it to be broadband enough. He either loses one end of the 70 centimeter or the other. He's distressed. Maybe you could help him out.
I hope we can. Now, there's a piece of PVC pipe, there's a vertical half-wave dipole, and then you said there's also a vertical half-wave 70 centimeter dipole. And the antenna is on 2 meters and 70 centimeters. So we got to go a little bit slow now. Give me a description. How long is the piece of PVC pipe? How far apart are these two vertical dipoles, if that's what they are? Or maybe one is horizontal and one is vertical. So how far apart are they? Are they in equal polarization? Is there a half-wave dipole on 2 meters and a half-wave dipole on 70 centimeters with separate transmission lines going into the diplexing filter assembly? So give me some more words on this one, John. KC2WGB, K2LAW in the TechNet.
2.WQVL repeater.
Okay, Dick. Yeah, there are two separate antennas with separate feed lines going to a diplexer. The PVC pipe is 10 feet long. Both antennas start on opposite sides of the pipe and go straight down. They're both half-wave. They're both made from two sections, center tap. And he's having a terrible time trying to get that 70 centimeter to two.
Okay, now let's run this way again. 10 feet of PVC pipe. Big number by my standards. Vertical dipole on 2 meters on one end. Vertical dipole and 70 centimeters on the other end.
One side of the pipe is the 2 meter. On the other side of the pipe is the 70 centimeter.
Whoa. Okay. The pipe is 10 feet long because he wants 10 feet of extra altitude?
Yes.
He wants 10 feet of extra altitude. That's why the pipe is 10 feet long. The half-wave dipole is end-mounted on 2 meters on one side of the pipe, end-mounted on 70 centimeters on the other side of the pipe. Am I putting in the right words now for the picture, John? Go ahead.